to the hearse. One of the pallbearers fumbled a bit, didn't let go, and almost found himself dragged into the hearse right along with it. Then the door was closed. The beautiful people slid into their cars, into the back seats behind their drivers, and the procession left, and Truman still remained, freezing cold despite the sun, a terrifying emptiness in which something cold and brittle rattled around. Maybe it was his heart. Maybe it was just the glass shards of the last vodka bottle, and he didn't know what to do next. He was Vivian Leigh at the end of Gone with the Wind, a tear-stained, remorseful bitch.
Oh, Rhett, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Rough day, huh, Truman?
Truman blinked, squinted his eyes. The cabbie was in front of him.
That's not the line, darling.
Huh?
Never mind.
Let's go home, huh, Truman? You don't look so good.
Neither do you, Truman retorted, but it wasn't malicious. He hiccuped, shook with drink and loss and grief, and allowed the cabbie to fold him back into the car.
Let's go home, chum.
As the yellow cab turned around in the now empty street, Truman leaned back, dizzy, and suddenly drenched in heat and sweat. He threw off the black cloak, crushing the flower beyond repair. He closed his eyes and slept. An hour later, he opened them. They were on Fifth Avenue.
Tell me, he cooed, rubbing his eyes. Are you single?
The cabbie's eyes met his in the rearview mirror. There was a flicker of interest that Truman had seen all his life in men of the heterosexual persuasion, who suddenly found themselves propositioned by a celebrity. But then the cabbie flashed an apologetic grin and said,
Nah.
Pity,
Truman replied, closing his eyes, resigned to his loneliness, now and forevermore. And then he took another drink. Because that's what Mama would want him to do.
I half expected Truman to show up, Pamela whispered, and though everyone leaned in to hear, they were not accosted by her bosom, as she had covered it up with black Italian lace for the solemn occasion. If he had, Bill would have thrown him out himself. Gloria sipped the impeccable wine that Babe had chosen for the occasion, her favorite Pouillet Fumé de la Doucette. They were at Kailuna, surrounded by Babe. In every flower, every white-jacketed waiter, every elegantly folded napkin, every soft note of music playing from the outdoor speakers, even the birds chirping, the scent of freesia, lilies, roses everywhere, she was there. The women were seated together. Their husbands surrounded Bill, a silent ring of wealthy and powerful bodyguards, protecting him from something none of them could recognize. But there was a threat nonetheless. They sensed it. And the threat was female, had they been able to think clearly. Already there were anxious women circling, hovering, waiting to have a sympathetic word with the new widower, to assure him they were there for him, would be happy to console him in his grief with a quiet dinner, just the two of them, some evening when he was up to it. Babe wouldn't have minded, I don't think, if Truman had been there, Slim said, and the others gasped in shock. No, really. Do you know what she said before she died? Nothing about him. At least not to me. You know, I saw her the day before, Gloria said icily. I saw her the evening before, Pamela pointed out. I was in Palm Beach, CZ said glumly, but I telephoned that night. Anyway, Slim interrupted, she told me that she had betrayed Truman, and not the other way around. No, all four gasped. Yes. She said that he thought we loved him, and that if we really had, we'd forgive him anything. That he was trying to test us, to see if we did after all, and so we failed him. I never said I loved him. Gloria was aghast. She began to twitch all over. How dare he? He was amusing, that's all. Amusing for a while. Talented, yes, of course, once upon a time, but no longer. And not to speak ill of the dead. She crossed herself vehemently, but Babies was an idiot. A soft-hearted idiot to think any differently. He betrayed us. Finny. You know how I feel about it all, CZ drawled, and everyone else stiffened in preparation, for they did know. You have only yourselves to blame, not Truman. I think he's a hell of a lot of fun. Well, not lately, but back then. Although he did bring me to that Studio 54 thing, which was exciting, but I wouldn't go back. But the point is, I never told him anything important. Not a thing. I kept it all fun and light with him, and so he had nothing to use. You all should have done the same. Slim, observing Gloria's neck begin to tense, her fingers fumble with the cutlery, hissed a warning. Remember what we're here for, girls. We're here for Babe. For her. I shouldn't have brought it up. Never mind. Gloria rose from her chair, stretched a little, balancing on the tips of her toes. Something in her knee popped, though, so she sank back down. In a way, Babe was the lucky one, she said, staring into the water glass, sensing the clouds begin to gather, soon to crowd out the sun.
Oh, Gloria, what could you possibly mean?
Marella shook her head. She was only 63. She got out with her beauty still more or less intact. Gloria smiled ruefully. She didn't have to grow old. Hellishly old. No one said anything, although each glanced at her own hands, then the hands of her friends. And where they once silently compared rings and jewels and bracelets, now they compared veins and wrinkles and dark spots.
How long do you think Bill will last before remarrying?
CZ nodded toward Bill, surrounded by his friends, his children. He looked dazed. He was eating a plate of Babe's marvelous food, but methodically, not with his usual gusto.
Not long, Gloria replied.
I think he'll stay single, Slim said defiantly. I think he'll be fine on his own. He'll surprise us all.
No, CZ shook her head. If ever there was a man who couldn't be single, it's Bill Paley. I'm grateful my Winston died before me. He couldn't have been on his own either. Men like that, men who are so focused on one thing, one great big thing, can't.
I wonder how long Truman will last now. No matter what we think of him. I'm positive he's devastated by this.
Pam mused, shrugging at Slim's glare.
Not long, CZ said with a sigh of true concern. Have you seen him on television lately? He's killing himself, just killing himself. It's like he wants to die, with all the booze and the coke and the pills.
Well, that's one way to go, Gloria retorted. And not a bad one, if he's really intent on doing himself in. He committed social suicide, and he caused a real suicide. Poor Anne. So who gives a damn if it leads to his own? Sometimes you just have to know when it's time to leave. You have to understand when your time is over. Your time in the sun.
Our time is over, you know.
With Babe gone, now it's well and truly over. The world isn't the same.
Slim narrowed her eyes at Gloria. Apparently, she was the type of person who made someone else's tragedy all about herself.
Shut up, Gloria. You're just feeling morbid today. So is everyone.
I don't know about you, but I intend to live forever.
Slim lit up a cigarette,
wincing at the fact that she didn't have to think of Babe anymore when she did. As for Truman, Slim retorted, inhaling in pure ecstasy, her eyes closed. He's like a snake. No, a cockroach. He'll outlive us all. Then she opened her eyes. They were full of tears. But Christ, wasn't it fun back then? Back when we were young? The swans nodded, each lost in her own thoughts. Primarily of Truman, to their surprise. On this day of Babe's funeral, it was Truman they were thinking of. Truman back then. Truman sitting like a little boy, lithe legs crossed, at their feet. His blue eyes big with wonder, his golden hair brushing his forehead. Truman reading his short stories at the 92nd Street Y, their pocket pet suddenly all grown up. Brilliant, electric, a new jewel in their collection. Truman and Babe dancing in the shadows at Kailuna, that meltingly beautiful, blissful smile on Babe's face. A sparkle in her eyes that none had seen before as she twirled around with abandon, finally sliding into Truman's arms, the two of them so content with each other, so at peace, that everyone else felt like intruders to look at them. Yet no one could take their eyes off the pair. That's what the swans remembered. As they drank Babe's wine and ate her food one last time, Truman and Babe. Darkness and light, elegance and impudence. Beauty and brains, heart and soul. Together. La Côte Basque, 1984. Bill, darling man, Slim. They air-kissed, then allowed the maitre d' to escort them to one of the front tables. The restaurant hadn't changed much since Henri Soulet's death in 1966, the year of Truman's ball. The seaside murals on the walls were still there, the linens still the finest, the tables still groaned with fresh flowers, the bill for these rumored to be in the thousands per week. There was a new chef, but the food was still heavy French, with an emphasis on cream and butter. Bill Paley and Slim Keith took their seats at an intimate table à deux. Instinctively, each sucked in his gut, sat up straight, scanned the room surreptitiously. But they were disappointed, it must be said. For few of their contemporaries were present. The restaurant was mainly filled with businessmen on expense accounts. Bill, of course, knew some of these and nodded, while Slim relaxed, let out her breath, and lit a cigarette. "Where the hell is everybody?" Slim asked, but it was a rhetorical question. She knew. They'd gotten old. Some had died. The Duke of Windsor had passed away even before Babe. Wallace was in France now, rumored to be mad as a hatter, locked away by servants. Morella and Gianni still puttered around on their yachts, but increasingly remained in Italy at their palace, forgotten gods taking refuge on Mount Olympus. Sisi still had her gardens, published many gardening books, and remained as unflappable as ever. Slim did still see her now and again when Sisi was in Manhattan, serving on charity boards, her blonde Boston beauty finely honed and weathered, so that she resembled that type of Brahmin matron she'd sworn she always loathed, but never tried too hard to prevent herself from becoming at that. For all her fun, her breeziness, her memories of Diego Rivera, CZ had always dressed like a debutante, and now like a figurehead with her pearls, cashmere, and tweed. Then there was Gloria, La Guinness, as Truman had dubbed her. Ah, Gloria. What do you think, Bill? Slim turned to her companion, now very stooped, thinner than his rangy frame warranted, His hair was very sparse, and he had a hearing aid in one ear.
What? He turned up the aid. What do you think about Gloria? Do you think she really did it? Commit suicide?
It was a heart attack, wasn't it?
Like many men his age, 83, his voice was querulous, high and loud. Not the commanding bark it once had been.
That's what Lowell said, anyway. But one of her maids... Well, it's just that she had been so despondent, so low, those last few years.
Gloria had died in 1980, only 2 years after she'd envied Babe for checking out before growing too old.
I don't believe that bunk.
Bill signaled for the waiter, ordered some wine for the two of them.
Not Gloria. Why would anyone do that? Especially her.
Because she was beautiful, Slim replied quietly. Once.
So were you. Still are, to some.
Bill grinned, and she glimpsed the man he had been, the man she'd known for more than 50 years, the man she first met before he married Babe on a fishing trip in Cuba with Papa. If she closed her eyes, she could visualize him then. Brown all over except for that blinding white smile. His hands, she remembered. That's what she first noticed about him. His hands, huge, always open, always grasping, wanting more.
Stop,
Slim retorted, slapping away one of those hands now as it grasped her knee.
We're too old for this.
We didn't used to be. We could go up to the apartment just like we used to.
Bill grinned and suddenly looked 10 years younger, maybe 20. And Slim relaxed. She allowed Bill to grasp her knee. She squeezed that huge hand, the fingers now knobby, arthritic, but the grasp still powerful, sure of what he desired. Certain that it could be attained. Sex hadn't packed up and left after all. She was surprised to feel that eager tingle between her thighs.
I assume your wife is out of town, then?
Slim knew it was cruel to remind him of their old game, but it slipped out. Bill released her hand. They both picked up their menus.
So, I imagine you heard about Truman.
Yeah.
Bill sighed, then frowned. That old Bill Paley icy glare.
Well, I can't say I'm sad about it, Slim. Not at all. Not after what he did to Babe. To you. To me.
Joanne Carson called me. You know, he'd been staying with her in that little room she had for him in Los Angeles. After we all banished him, that's where he ended up, in the back room of a TV star's ex-wife.
Slim smiled grimly.
But she called me after they took him away to the mortuary. She said that his last words were, "Beautiful babe." She wanted me to know that for some reason.
Slim choked a little, her eyes misting over with tears.
Do you really believe that?
I'd like to.
Wouldn't you? No. I don't want to believe that little bastard was still in love with my wife. I don't want to believe his last words were about her. I don't want to believe anything other than Babe died peacefully, loving only me, and that Truman died painfully, alone. Call me cruel if you want, but...
That's the story you want to tell yourself,
Slim whispered.
I understand, Bill, because I tell myself a lot of stories to help me sleep at night. Stories about how Babe was my dearest friend and I never betrayed her. Stories about how you and I had a great love, not just an occasional roll in the hay whenever she was out of town. Stories about how wonderful life was back then,
when none of us told each other the truth, but so what? It was all so beautiful, wasn't it? It was all so lovely and gracious. Not like it is now.
Neither spoke for a long time. They just gazed out at 55th Street, full of tourists in their tourist clothes, sneakers and jeans, sweatshirts, windbreakers, those absurd Walkman headphones over their ears, blocking out the delicious sounds of the city. The St. Regis was just across the street, and still grand, but now rock stars stayed in the suites and nobody lived in hotels anymore. And it was owned by Sheridan. Astors and Vanderbilts and Bears, oh my. No one was afraid of any of them and their old money now. Not in the garish New York of the 80s and Donald Trump. Bill Paley was still chairman of CBS, despite efforts over the last few years to oust him. Still, he was selling off stock, a little bit at a time. His days of acquisition were over. He'd already made plans to give his astounding collection of art to MoMA. Mostly, he played golf and swam and slept in his office between meetings, at which he still made appearances, just to remind people who built the damn place, after all. To remind himself of that as well.
"We do have a great love,"
Bill told Slim, told himself, as he told every woman he still took up to the apartment on Fifth. Even now. Why hadn't he just been named one of People magazine's top 10 eligible bachelors? Although every time he brought some little cutie up there, he couldn't stop himself from giving a tour. A running narrative of Babe. Babe bought this. Babe put that there. Babe used to sit here. Babe felt that the dining room should be in this color. He'd never changed the apartment. Had resisted efforts from his children to redecorate there and at Kailuna. He couldn't bring himself to. They were the last things in the world he had of her. Her essence. That gracious living that Slim was talking about. He knew everything she had picked out was now out of fashion, but he didn't care. He was too old to care.
"No, we don't have a great love, Bill. You were kind and very generous with money when I needed it. I was there for a diversion when you needed it, one of your blonde shiksas. And I have to ask you a question, now that Truman's gone. Do you think Babe ever knew, Bill? Did Truman? Because the story, Truman's story in Esquire about Sidney Dillon and the bloody stain... Did you ever tell him about that? That one time with us?
No. Did you?
No.
Truth or consequences. That old familiar game. Neither really wanted to play it after all.
But Babe,
Slim said after a pause, unable to let the subject drop as she knew she ought.
Babe said something before she died. She said I was a survivor. It seemed odd at the time, out of the blue. And then, you know, she didn't leave me much in her will, not like everyone else. God knows I didn't care about that. Except it did seem strange, considering how generous she was with everyone else, like Gloria and Morella and CZ. I don't know. I just wonder.
Babe didn't know. She couldn't. How? She could never have known that the woman in the story was you. Although she sure as hell knew the man was me.
And Bill remembered how bitter Babe was those last couple of years. How free she was with her regrets. Her suspicions. Her accusations.
I hope she didn't know.
Slim whispered, picking up a fork. Weighing it in her hands, enjoying the cool heaviness of fine silver.
But I wonder.
Don't worry about it, Slim. It's over. They're both gone, and we're left. We're left with the memories. Not a great love, no, Bill. I don't think either of us was capable of that. But Truman and Babe, they were... Well, Babe was, anyway. And I think that blinded her, because in the end, Truman was Truman. But he did what we never could. He began to speak the truth. Not someone else's truth. Not Perry Smith's or Holly-Golightly's or even his own. No. He began to tell the truth about us. And the thing is, Bill, darling, the truth is ugly. Yours, mine, even Babe's. Bill made a garbled, anguished sound. Slim saw his throat working as if he was trying to swallow something. And she grasped his hand again and placed it against her breasts, her saggy, deflated breasts, so that he could feel her heart, her femininity, her warm, solid self. She closed her eyes, enjoyed a man's hand upon her breasts for the first time in eons, and knew, right now, that she was alive. She was still here, not a memory, not a relic, not some old woman nobody looked at twice on the street. Not some forgotten name in a faded magazine. An answer to the question of, where are they now? She opened her eyes. Bill was grinning at her with that ageless boy's leer, quite at odds with his watery, faded eyes, his visible hearing aid. But he had relaxed, his hand still upon her breasts, until she removed that hand and tucked it back on his own lap. So I still like to see you, my friend. I still like to sit in La Côte Basque and sip wine and eat fine food and indulge in our memories. The good ones. The ones we want to remember. So let's do that. That's the story we can tell ourselves at night when we can't sleep. We can tell ourselves that there is one other person in the world who sees it in the same way. Who remembers. Who remembers her, Babe, and Gloria, and even Truman, I guess, as he was back then, our fun, gossipy friend. Our entree into a different world for a time. An amusing, brief little time. A time before it was fashionable to tell the truth, and the world grew sordid from too much honesty. Slim raised her glass. So did Bill. To Babe. To Truman. To Papa and all the other glittering, prevaricating ghosts of the past. To Babe, Bill echoed, and they clinked their glasses together in a toast and spent the rest of the afternoon talking about their grandchildren.
In the end, as in the beginning, all they had were the stories they told about one another, and the stories they told to themselves.
I loved her. She was the great love of my life, my only regret.
Truman breathed near the end as he lay exhausted from the world, from abuse, from himself. Always himself.
I loved him. He was the great love of my life,
Babe whispered to herself as she closed her eyes and gave up the struggle, for it was ugly, and she'd never done an ugly thing in her life, and she wasn't about to start now.
I'm alone,
they each thought, and one was amused, the other appalled.
Mama.
Truman whispered, as a stranger held his hand and called for an ambulance.
Truman.
Babe thought she said aloud, as she felt herself sinking, sinking, and then rising. But then she knew she didn't, and then she didn't know anything, ever again.
Beautiful, Babe,
Truman said, and he knew he said it. He heard his own voice, very weak, strange to his ears. And then he heard no more. Now there were no more stories to tell, to soothe, to comfort, to draw strangers close together, to link like hearts and minds, to wound, to hurt, to destroy the one thing they each loved more than anything else. Beauty. Beauty in all its glory, in all its iterations. The exquisite moment of perfect understanding between two lonely, damaged souls sitting silently by a pool, or in the twilight, or lying in bed, vulnerable and naked, in every way that mattered. The haunting glance of a woman who knew she was beautiful because of how she saw herself reflected in her friend's eyes. The splendor of belonging, being included, prized, coveted. The loveliness of a flower, lilies of the valley, teardrop blossoms, snowy white against glossy green foliage, made lovelier because of the friend's hand tenderly proffering the blossom, a present, a balm. The beauty of understanding tears in an understanding face. The beauty of a perfectly tailored shirt, crisp, blinding white, just out of the box. The beauty of a swirl of taffeta, the tinkling of bells, diamonds, emeralds, the pristine paper flower. Beauty. The swans swam ahead, always ahead, their bodies gliding so that none could see the effort of their feet beneath the surface, paddling, moving, propelling them forward, forward, to that beautiful spot far ahead, an incandescent curtain of light, a shower of moonbeams, a heavenly constellation of stars. His body, however, was not like theirs. The effort always showed, and he panted and grunted, trying to keep up, sometimes managing to sprint ahead, but always his brow perspired, his chest heaved, his breathing was labored. Sometimes the lead swan held out her hand, long and white and graceful, sometimes revealing rubies, sometimes emeralds, sometimes empty, waiting only for his hand to grasp it. And the two of them smiled their conspirator's smile, and he felt himself no longer working so hard or falling behind, and it was effortless, the two of them together, pulling ahead of the others, sometimes turning to wink or grin. But then, at the end, as the radiance began to descend upon them, raining down diamonds and sea glass, something happened. He never knew what, only that he faltered once, smiled, danced, turned his back or ran too far ahead. He never could quite understand which it was. But he closed his eyes, opened them, and found himself once more back on the shore, his feet caked in mud, rooted, left behind. Alone. And the swans swam on toward that shimmering waterfall of luminescence. They never looked back. No matter how much he cried, how he screamed until his throat was raw and his face was red, they glided forward, one by one disappearing into the slender shadows between the moonbeams, the lead swan allowing the others to go ahead. She stood guard, watching them. And finally, she turned to gaze at him once more with those grave, understanding eyes, and he screeched her name, begged her forgiveness, pleaded her favor. But she turned away to follow the others. And she, too, vanished into the shadows between the light, and there was nothing left of any of them, only the faint ripples of their wake in the water, which he watched and watched with tears in his eyes, tears that turned into diamonds, that turned into dust. The tremors of that wake widening, spreading, rippling into the crystal-dusted indigo of the pond that was the lake, that was the ocean, that was the dream of a forgotten world. Until it, too, disappeared.
Author's note. When I was a girl, I was one of those people who were drawn to New York. I was born and raised in Indianapolis, Indiana. A lovely place, but I always had the sense that I didn't quite belong. Somehow, and I honestly don't remember how on earth this was possible, when I was fairly young, I got my hands on copies of Vanity Fair and The New Yorker. I suppose maybe they were carried in the local library, or perhaps the one bookstore at the mall stocked them. All I know is the first time I opened The New Yorker, not quite understanding the cartoons but pretending I did, I realized, finally, where I was meant to be. And so I wished myself onto these magazines' sophisticated pages. I read about and imagined I knew intimately people like Norman Mailer and Gore Vidal and Brooke Astor. I devoured descriptions of nightlife and openings and galas and vignettes about Central Park, Tiffany, Bergdorf Goodman, 21. Truman Capote was always featured in the pages of these magazines. And of course, I knew about him. I saw him on television, a bloated, campy figure waving his hands, telling outrageous stories. I saw him in Murder by Death, which at age 13, I thought to be hilariously witty. I knew that Truman Capote was the author of a book called In Cold Blood, a book my mother owned but wouldn't let me read. That was about all I knew about him from a literary perspective, however. He was simply one of those flamboyant 1970s characters, just like Liza Minnelli and Halston and the Village People. In the pages of Vanity Fair, I also read frequently of a woman named Babe Paley, a fashion icon. That was always how she was described, along with other names like Gloria Guinness, Mirella Agnelli, and Slim Keith. By the time I was aware of these women, they were already spoken of reverently in the past, a past that was still longed for even in the late 1970s. They were ghostly, beautiful images to me, wearing clothes that were exquisite and unattainable. I didn't know anything about fashion, of course. I got all my clothes at Sears and J.C. Penney, but I dreamed of fashion, just as I dreamed of New York. And the only thing I regret in my life is that I didn't get there. I was a child of the Midwest, of Midwestern parents who, well-intentioned, instilled the fear of God in big cities in me, even as I visualized myself on gritty urban streets, fantasized about taking the subway, longed to be surrounded by skyscrapers and people who talked loudly and in interesting accents. But the fear went out, I'm sorry to say, for a very long time. But these people and these streets have lived in my imagination ever since, and I've read everything there is about them. Party of the Century by Deborah Davis, about Truman Capote's famous black-and-white ball, Capote by Gerald Clark, Truman Capote by George Plimpton, Fifth Avenue 5 A.M. by Sam Wasson, Slim, the memoir of Slim Keith, and The Sisters by David Grafton, about Babe Paley and her sisters. I've seen Breakfast at Tiffany's more times than I can count. I continue to subscribe to both Vanity Fair and The New Yorker. And, of course, now I've read Capote's own work and admired most of it. Other Voices, Other Rooms, In Cold Blood, his short stories, and Breakfast at Tiffany's. The only work of his that I didn't admire, and which was rather a shock to read, was Answered Prayers, which included the short story La Côte Basque 1965. It didn't seem like his other writing. Not at all. I tallied it up to an unfortunate mistake. But then, one day, I decided to learn more about this unfinished novel. I had known vaguely that it resulted in a good old-fashioned literary scandal. I understood the basic details. Truman had divulged secrets that he shouldn't have. He'd tattled and called it literature. His friends had shunned him, and then he turned into that grotesque figure I knew from my youth. And then he died. But of course, there is more to the story than that. Isn't there always? At the heart of everything written about Truman Capote and Answered Prayers is always the story of his friendship with Babe Paley. Babe is a sometimes aloof, if gorgeous, creature. To me, she's always a bit heartbreaking. The original trophy wife. I've seen that phrase used to describe her often. Yet that friendship kept buzzing about my brain. That unusual friendship between the grotesque Truman and the exquisite Babe. How? Why? What did it really mean to the two of them? When I looked at photos and I saw how physically stunning Truman was, back when this relationship was new, I was astonished. This was not the Truman Capote I had known growing up. And that was the puzzle to me. What had happened to him to turn him into the caricature I remember, that we all remember when we hear the name Truman Capote? What had happened between him and Babe, who was purported by so many who knew him to be the one person he had ever loved? What had happened to them all, these mythological creatures in their penthouses? What had happened to New York, to sophistication, to elegance, to fairy tales? That's what I wanted to write about. That's the story I wanted to tell. What happened to Truman Capote? What happened to his swans? What happened to elegance? What truly was the price they paid for the lives they lived? For there is always a price, especially in fairy tales. With every book I write, I am more aware that some readers are very curious to know what is fact and what is fiction. I have to say, this book has been the most fun to write by far, since all of its characters were incurable liars in life. This gave me quite a lot of leeway, and it was tremendously interesting to imagine myself into all of these wonderful storytellers' lives. But for those who are curious, here are some guidelines. All conversations are imagined. Although some, like the conversation between Truman Capote and Liz Smith near the end, are known to have occurred. But what exactly was said? That is what I fictionalize. The timeline is faithful. The fallout from Answered Prayers is true to life. The relationships are real. In other words, Truman and Babe and Bill Paley were that tight little trio. Slim was Babe's closest female friend. And the salient facts are, from life, Anne Woodward was suspected of murdering her husband. She did commit suicide after reading La Côte Basque, 1965. Babe Paley did have cancer. Truman Capote did die in Joanne Carson's guest room, and so on. The biggest liberty I took concerns the rumored identity of the woman with whom the Bill Paley character had an affair in La Côte Basque, 1965. At the time, the gossip was that it was Happy Rockefeller, the wife of the governor. More likely, the woman in the story was an amalgamation of the many women with whom Paley had affairs, including, if the gossip was to be believed, Slim Keith. While Slim was definitely the model for Ina Coolberth in the story, it is also a fact that Babe did not, in her will, leave her dear friend very much. Who told her then about Slim and Bill? Who indeed? As I always say, the emotions are what I imagine. The motivations and intent behind some of these documented acts. The facts are the bones upon which I stretch the fictionalized flesh. And I hope that you are inspired, after listening to The Swans of Fifth Avenue, To learn more about these extraordinary, impossibly glamorous, yet ultimately tragic lives on your own. The books I mentioned earlier are excellent places to start, along with Sally Bedell Smith's In All His Glory, The Life of William S. Paley, and Conversations with Capote by Lawrence Grobel. I never did make it to New York to live, but I did make it to Chicago, which I love. Finally, I'm a big city girl, and I visit New York a lot now. I see ghosts in the streets everywhere I go. Once, in the plaza, I thought I saw Babe Paley and Truman Capote sitting in a corner, having a glass of champagne. But it was only a dream, after all. This is Cassandra Campbell. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Swans of Fifth Avenue by Melanie Benjamin. This program was directed by Arthur Gianzano. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2016 by Melanie Hauser. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.